Right. Here we go. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining today. I appreciate everybody taking the time, the end of the day, long day, to talk through some of the data application capabilities that we have available in Azure. My name is Lara Rebelke. I am a software development engineer at Microsoft. I work both with our ISV partners to help them build applications to run on our cloud. I also work with engineering, so I work with those developers, the engineers that are creating the services that we'll be showing today. I've got a storied, long and storied career in the area of data analytics and data processing. I've been working in this space for decades. But for Microsoft for about 8 years in multiple roles. One of my favorite roles and what introduced me to that next generation of data processing started about 5 years ago when I had the opportunity to work with a team of seven people that were building a new service on Azure. And they had it codenamed Isotope. And this was an opportunity for us to look at how we could bring Hadoop to Azure as a service. And that had later become HD Insight. So I was part of this very small team of about seven engineers that were bringing this together. And then later, as we brought it to market, it moved into out of incubation to a team of about 100. And I moved on to the next thing. So I've had a lot of great experience at Microsoft, and that really jump-started the opportunity to move beyond just relational. And I'm going to say that it's not just relational, that there are a number of services that you use to compose data applications that include relational, as well as some of the other services we'll talk through today that bring together your data architecture. There are dozens of data services in Azure. How many here are using Azure for data processing today? Okay, just a couple, just a couple. For the rest of you, if you haven't been introduced to Azure and data processing, this is going to be a good opportunity. This is a good session to get an understanding of which services fit in the context of what you want to do with your data. And just like you may see on-prem, in the cloud, you have a lot of different choices. And what I want to do is put it in the context of something like the Lambda architecture. This is not the same thing as AWS and what they have a service called Lambda. That's a completely different thing. Lambda architecture is simply a way that, and this has been around much earlier, much longer than the Lambda service in AWS. Lambda architecture defines how you may process your data to answer certain questions and address latency requirements. And so we're going to walk through that Lambda architecture so you can have an understanding of why you might apply the different data services. And then we're going to look at some of those services and how they apply to the different data needs that you have for your application. The key point is we are well beyond a time where you have a single store of data and you have a single way that you process your data. We are in a space just like other applications, especially with the cloud, that it's about composing multiple services to create an entire data application. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Does that sound okay? All right. Well, we're going to have fun with data. I love data. So this, to me, is just one of my favorite topics to go through because it gives me an opportunity to talk with so many people about what they're doing with data and vet out how we can use the different services. This is not going to be what we'll talk about today is not going to be a black and white situation. I'm going to talk through some options. And it's a lot of times it comes down to you'll have three different services or three different choices. And sometimes when you really look at it, it's pretty clear which service you want to use. But sometimes it's not, and it's trial and error. Or it just might be preference. You might just prefer a certain kind of service. And that is totally okay. So we're going to go through a lot of the different services. But before we do that, let's look at what this Lambda architecture means. How many here have heard about the Lambda architecture? The same people that were doing Azure. There we go. So for the rest of the room, let's have a look at what this means. And we'll put it in context of what we've been doing all the way up to now, and in some cases, before now. But we have this traditional architecture of data processing where you have source systems, and you might move that data using an ETL engine like SQL Server Integration Services or Informatica, but you have an engine that moves the data, transforms the data, and loads it into another engine for reporting and analysis. Sometimes they call this an enterprise data warehouse. Has anyone built an enterprise data warehouse, a single source of truth for all enterprise data? Has anyone tried? Yeah, it doesn't exist, right? There are lots of data marts, there are lots of data warehouses, but I have never seen a successful single source of truth, single enterprise data warehouse for all company data. Other data is going to sit elsewhere in your enterprise. It might be under somebody's desk. It might be on their laptop. But the point being that you've got these systems, and out of those systems, you're going to move the data, you're going to transform it, and then you're process it in batch. You're going to move it to a data warehouse that's optimized for large-scale retrieval and queries, and that will connect to your end-user systems. This is familiar to most people in the room, right? Yeah, this is nothing new. The way things are moving, the direction it's moving, is that now you have lots of sources. It's no longer that it's just a source system. We have these things out there, and lots of them. We have the Internet of Things. And sometimes I even say that let's not get stuck on this concept of it has to be a sensor or a device. There are data-producing endpoints. Those endpoints could be people, they could be some other system, but there's a lot of endpoints producing data. And that data is being processed and queried as it streams. You're doing an ingestion of that original data. You're doing a process on that data. You're storing it into large-scale systems like Hadoop, or in our case, blob storage, and then it's being made available for your end-user query systems. So you have a notion of streaming data and processing as that in micro-batch versus the big batch, these micro-batch or streaming processing, and landing it into your systems. So the way this works with Lambda, then, we still have this batch process. We still have all that data that's your raw data, the original data. I call it data as data is born. You will always keep the original data. You will land that into some kind of system. And then you might do some pre-computed views over that data, aggregate it, and move it into an optimized engine, where it can then be served to your final users. At the same time, you have different questions you want to ask of your data that require much lower latency. Those questions need to be answered almost at the time that the data was generated. And that is this buffered ingest, and they'll call it a hot path or a speed layer. And the speed layer is going to process the stream. You might see some views off of that stream. You're going to have this real-time data, and we do quotes around real-time because it's actually extremely low latency. Real time just isn't possible. There's always going to be some latency from the time the data is born, but it's extreme low latency, and then it's put out to some kind of system, and your users can view the data. So in short, you're going to have a hot path, which is the speed layer, and you'll have a cold path, which is your traditional batch processing layer. And these two layers combined enable you to answer just about any question that you may need from that data. So that, in short, is what a Lambda architecture means. The way that it might be realized in an application, this is an architecture of, you know, it's not, this actually was implemented, that I built when I worked with a company called Emerson Electric for a new processing engine for their sensor data. So this was an IoT application, and you can see that the data is coming off of their sensors. They're using a buffered ingestion with Kafka, and we'll talk about the different choices. The data streams through Storm, archives off of Storm. It also is archiving off the buffered ingestion into cold storage. The hot path is going through Storm, doing an analysis against a machine learning algorithm as the data streams, looking for events as close to the time that that event was generated to do predictive and prescriptive analysis. And the rest of that is your traditional. It's going to be available through Power BI or other kinds of reporting tools, et cetera. But this is an actual real implementation. And as I built this with them about 4 years ago. And since that time, might use different services here and there, but a lot of the same kind of architecture does continue to resonate with other customers and partners I've worked with. So as we look at a detailed view, you have a buffered ingestion layer. This is your traditional kind of pub sub or some kind of a layer that is a messaging layer that will collect the data and then allow other systems to connect to it and process the data. It may process up through the hot path, where it might do some event decoration, they call it. And this is basically where, as the data is streaming, it may connect and join with other data before it lands into a hot store. Hot store is something that can handle the scale of writes and reads for large applications. On the cold path, it's going to spool or stream that raw data into a storage container, into a storage account. And it's important that in this case, it's that raw data as data is born. So we don't apply schema or a schema to that data until after the data has been stored into its raw form. That way, in the future, you can make any kind of additional schema choices and process the data differently, but you'll always have that raw archive. You'll do some curation. Curation is going to happen with batch processing, usually. Big, giant ETL engine. And then it's going to be served and consumed by different engines for different needs. The most obvious one that everybody thinks about is Power BI, or Tableau, or a reporting engine, right? But also under serving and consumption, it might actually land into a different store by which a data scientist might connect to it. And we'll talk about what that means in a little while. So the way that we see this, there are kind of four main categories of the data services. And we'll look at this in context of these four categories. We've got ingestion, processing, staging, and then serving and consumption. There's actually one more layer, if we look at it this way, that there's also enrichment and curation. And when we line up our Azure services, you can see how they start to align to the different types of data processing that you will do. This could be in the cloud, it could be on-prem. These are what we're talking about today will be our cloud options. Now, there's a lot of services. These are just a handful that I typically use in my applications. And we won't go through each one in detail because we only have an hour today, so we can't do that. But what I'll do is go deeper into a couple and hopefully, you know, show you how a couple could get set up easily. I do want to point out, for those that want to learn more and want to understand this a little better, one of my favorite things to do is take an existing solution, an existing sample, an existing demo, and reverse engineer it. Isn't that a great way to learn? There are great templates out there that you can deploy into your Azure subscription, which you can have a trial subscription, go deploy this. And then you can go look at the services, how they were deployed, how they were connected, and reverse engineer it and see how we built the system. And there's wonderful templates out there. So if I were to even just go out here, under Cortana, gallery.cortanaintelligence.com, you'll see that there's this tab called Solution Templates. Whoops, I am not. Hold on. We're going to come back here. You can't see what I'm seeing. And now you can. I'll just go this route. There we go. So there are these solution templates. So if you go to Cortana Intelligence, gallery.cortanaintelligence.com, and you go to Solution Templates, you can see that there are a few samples out here. And you can deploy any one of these. It's as easy as selecting the solution template. And then in the right, you click Deploy. It's going to ask you for a few questions. What's the name of your subscription? What is a prefix you want to give to the services? That way it groups things together nicely. And it just walks you through. And then once it walks you through all of this, so we'll just, for example, give our solution name, Decode. Select a subscription. You can see I've got a lot of subscriptions. I must work for Microsoft. You agree, and then you click Next. I'm not going to do this because I've already deployed it, and it does take about 20 minutes. It's deploying a lot of services. When it's done, so if we just click out of this, when it's done, you'll see something like this. And this is a really nice navigation. So let me see, did I turn on Zoom It? I did not. Let me turn on Zoom It because you'll want to see this stuff zoomed in, right? I think I got it right here. There we go. You can see that it's got the hot path, the cold path, the whole thing. This actually is a nice representation of what we were talking about with the Lambda architecture. We've got the buffered ingestion through Event Hub in this case. We'll talk about the choices. It's going through Stream Analytics for the hot path, where it's processing a query on that stream of data. It's not even persisting anyplace. It's just processing a query on a stream of data. It's landing that data into a persistent storage with blobs. We're doing curation with HD Insight off to the left here. Off to the left here, HD Insight, where it's doing batch processing and curation of the data. It moves curated data to Azure SQL Data Warehouse. It's a nice relational engine optimized for query and retrieval for end users. And then we've got Power BI to serve the data. Now, what we do for the enrichment and curation, whoops, is also this Azure Data Factory, which is an orchestration service. You often need something out there that will basically tell your system to a workflow for how that data is processed. It's a workflow engine. Does that seem cool? Very helpful. Go out there, just deploy these things and just play with it. Word of warning, when you're done playing, go delete the solution. If you leave it running, these services will cost you some money, so delete the services when you're done playing. You can always redeploy it the next day. Just to spend 20 minutes to redeploy, okay? But don't let it stay running, especially HD Insight, that one can spin up and cost some money. So tip to the wise. So let's go back and look at some of these slides again. So we saw this, and so let's go through the layers. We've got buffered ingestion. And as I mentioned, buffered ingestion is basically a messaging layer. It's a layer to collect the data and then forward it to other systems. Those other systems may subscribe to that buffering layer and say, I would like the data, and it might subscribe based on certain filter criteria. The buffered ingestion is often thought of in context of that hot path, but it can also be useful in the cold path. In fact, I often use the buffered ingestion for everything now. If you're doing any kind of processing off of sensor data or even telemetry data, event hubs, service hub, these are all good friends to have. In fact, the options for ingestion include IoT Hub, which is a new service in Azure designed specifically for IoT scenarios. IoT Hub is based off of Event Hub, so it's got all the same characteristics of Event Hub plus some others. IoT Hub, where Event Hub is for mass ingestion, think of Event Hub as perfect if you're connecting to a Twitter stream. You don't want to send a message back to everybody who tweets. You don't need to control the Twitter stream. You just want to mass ingest that stream. IoT Hub is great when you're connecting a device, and it requires bi-directional communication. So you need to not just connect the device, but you may need to send a message back to the device. You might need to flash it. You might need to have it do something, react to your data. So IoT Hub is designed for those scenarios. Service Bus is the original ingestion tool. This was where it all started in Azure. And it is like Event Hub with a whole lot more. And it's often going to be too expensive for IoT scenarios. It's great if you need to do some advanced filtering or processing rules so that as that data comes in, you can process very specific rules based on what data is coming in and the values of the data. For things like IoT, you often don't do that. You just stream it. And the final one is Kafka. Has anyone worked with Kafka? It's a Microsoft place, I guess. Kafka is much, much more used in the open source community. So in the open source community, you'll often find Kafka paired up with Storm and Spark and the open source Apache tools. So I don't know if this resonates here, but in the United States, I would say things like Kafka and Storm go together like peanut butter and jelly. Now, I said that in the UK, and everybody kind of got grossed out because I guess jelly means jello, which is a different, peanut butter and jello is bad. Anyway, I digress. I'm sorry. So that's ingestion. When you want to process that data, we're going to go through the hot path to start. And we're going to look at things like Stream Analytics, Storm, and Spark Streaming. And in fact, we're not going to go deep into all of them, but I do want to point out that we've got all options available as a service in Azure. And when I say as a service, it means that you can send a command line, or you can send any your DevOps. You just went through all the DevOps this week. But you can send some kind of command to say, instantiate or create this service for me. I'm going to send you data. You don't have to do any kind of management of that service. We take care of managing the service and the servers for you. Stream Analytics is something that we created at Microsoft. Storm is an open source solution that is available as a service. Spark Streaming is also an open source solution available as a service. When you're processing the hot path, you're typically going to connect to that ingestion layer. The most common I see are going to be Event Hub and IoT Hub. And soon we will be making available Kafka as a service. So it's not available as a service yet, but soon we will make that available. And we'll start to see that become more popular as well. If we look at how many here are actually doing any kind of stream processing on-prem or in the cloud today? You just raise your hand for everything, don't you? He's going to teach this session next. Fantastic. If you've never done stream processing, I typically recommend starting with Stream Analytics. The reason I recommend starting with Stream Analytics is, how many here can write a SQL query? Everybody's hand goes up, right? My 13-year-old can write a SQL query. We learn this. You know this stuff. Stream Analytics is as simple as writing a SQL query. And in fact, why don't I just jump over and show you? So we're going to actually keep doing that. Got to turn that off so I can show you. If we go to Stream Analytics, and unfortunately, what I want to show you, I have to go to the old management portal. There's two portals. We're still trying to rationalize this at Microsoft, and it's coming along. But there was one thing in Stream Analytics I wanted to show you, so I'm going to the old portal. To create a Stream Analytics job, you basically are going to connect to a source, you're going to specify a destination, and you're going to create a query. Back in the olden days, about 4 years ago, in order to do some kind of stream processing, it required specialized skills, specialized hardware, specialized software, and then a lot of patience to try and bring it together. And if you used open source, it required Java. And while I often ask how many people know Java and hands go up, I also ask how many people love Java. All the hands go down. It's not the funnest language to program in, I get that. People wanted something that was more approachable, and along came Stream Analytics. It's very approachable. So as I said, you're going to specify an input. An input is as simple as running through a wizard where I could say I want to connect to a stream of data. It will be my event hub. This could also be IoT hub. I specify the name of this, so we'll just call this input one. Which subscription has my event hub, the name of my event hub workspace, and the name of my event hub. And I'm just going to take these defaults. We're not going to keep this. And that's it. After that, I've connected my source. I want to run a query on that data. The data is streaming. An important differentiator. How many have heard about this thing called NoSQL with no schema? All data has schema. It's when you apply it, right? All data. There's no such thing as schemaless. So if somebody tries to tell you it's schema free, all data has schema. You just might apply it later. We're applying the schema on the stream as it's streaming. And in this case, we applied the schema via a query. You can write this, right? All the hands go up. Yes, we all write SQL. Yes. So I am going to select from my input. This is my input that I just created, well, the one I created earlier. And I'm going to push it to something called an output. And this is the name of my output. And then the final piece is I add an output. And in this case, I have a lot of output choices out of the box. But the one I wanted to show you is Power BI. Because this is a way that you can have live updating dashboards off a stream of data. And that's kind of a fun way to get started. And I'm all about fun. All I need to do is authorize it. So I give it my login credentials. at microsoft.com. It's probably going to ping me. Sign in with my multi-factor authentication. How's that for security, gang? Woohoo! Got one more password to give it for multi-factor authentication. My cloud is secure. And it's going to authenticate, and then we're in. So I've authorized, and now I just give it a name. So we'll just call this output. And we're going to call the data set name, Lara, table name, Lara, and that's it. That's all I needed to do. To set up Azure Stream Analytics, you can do this in minutes. In the olden days, 4 years ago, that would have taken weeks, if not longer. You can start playing with this today and experimenting with how you can use these new Azure structures to enhance your applications. Okay? Now, once you've got that created, then the data starts streaming and it's being made available. I would have to start that job. The job takes about 2 minutes to start sometimes, so we won't start it. I just wanted to walk through that experience. So let's go back here. As I mentioned, there are other hot path options. Storm is a great option. It's very well known in the open source community. There is a lot of adoption. And it scales beautifully. So I could certainly advocate for Storm. And Spark is the new kid on the block, and it's performing really well. We're going to talk about Spark a little bit later as well, but Spark is something that if people were looking at going beyond an Azure Stream Analytics and they wanted something that has a multi-cloud, they can deploy that code to multiple clouds or on-prem. You're typically looking at Storm and Spark. I probably would lean towards Spark today, just because the level of adoption is increasing very heavily, and you're seeing a lot of contributions from the community. So that is streaming. That's your hot path. Now let's go through the cold path. So we talked through that very low latency. The data is being queried as it's processing. It never even landed while it was doing a query and maybe doing some kind of a window function to say what's the last, the highest value in the last 5 minutes as that window of time moves. That is what we just talked through. Now we're going to go into more familiar territory, and that's our batch processing cold path storage. And for this, we've got a number of options, and more are continuing to be made available. In Azure, we've got HD Insight, which I talked about at the beginning. It's Apache Hadoop running as a service. We've also got Azure Data Lake, and I'll talk about that in a little bit, kind of help demystify what Data Lake is and means. We've got Spark, and if you notice, Spark shows up on both the hot path and the cold path, which is very interesting. The rest of these are either one or the other. That one, I think, is very interesting. Azure SQL Database can indeed be part of this solution as a staging, and Data Warehouse can also be part of that staging solution and storage. So the cold path processing, as we talked about earlier, is typically going to be batch. It's very batchy. You land your data into storage. You're going to do iterative and batch queries and movement of that data to land it into a curated final destination where later users can connect to it and ask questions. Typically, the questions people are asking are things like, what is my year-over-year increase in sales? What is my month-over-month decrease in viability? What is my lifetime whatever? These are typically going to be large processed time series kinds of queries, period-over-period, month-over-month. Usually very familiar to your data warehouse space. Azure Data Lake. Has anybody heard about Azure Data Lake yet? Okay. Yay. So hands are going up. Yay. Banzai. I have to say, I only know like two Japanese words, and so you're going to hear two of them. So thank you. Azure Data Lake is actually a collection of a couple of services. I think most people think about Azure Data Lake as data lake storage. This is where I'm going to send my data. It's going to sit there and be processed by something else. So Azure Data Lake storage is absolutely one part of that puzzle. The other part is the analytics service, Azure Data Lake Analytics. Azure Data Lake Analytics includes this new functional language that we are bringing to market called USQL with a U, USQL. USQL is really interesting because it's very much C-sharp and PIG. If you've worked with Apache Hadoop in the past, you probably are familiar with PIG. PIG is basically SQL in slow motion. It's an iterative kind of functional processing of your data. It's pretty easy to learn, and it's easy to read and understand. USQL is a lot like that, except it takes it to the next level and also connects to the .NET framework and allows you to then use all of the great C-sharp functions and functional capabilities within that iteration. Most people that start using it, they love it. The challenge that you might find is that it is going to be Azure only. So we don't yet have this available on-prem, so that's one consideration. In addition to Azure Data Lake Analytics, we do have HD Insight, Apache Hadoop running as a service. And very often, we use this as a large batch processing engine. I will call it like that big giant ETL engine. It can connect to large scales of data and process it at scale, distribute it across a lot of different machines so that it can come back with the results much faster. And faster is faster in context of a large volume of data. That is Azure Data Lake. So Azure Data Lake is not just the storage. It actually is a collection of a number of services. Now, HD Insight is by itself also a collection of a few different types of services. You can create an HD Insight cluster and say, I would like to have Apache Hadoop, maybe you want HBase, maybe you want Storm, and also you can say, I might want Spark. You may have heard about Spark. A lot of people are paying a lot of attention to Spark. And for a good reason. Spark is in-memory distributed scale-out processing. In-memory. That means it can be pretty fast. It doesn't have to write to disk like your traditional HD Insight or batch processing every time it does a batch or every iteration on that data. It can keep that data in memory and process in memory. One of the things you may not know about Spark is that Microsoft actually did have some contributions at the beginning. Spark was built out of, I think it was Berkeley, UC Berkeley, and the professors at UC Berkeley decided they wanted to build this engine because they had read a paper on a solution at Microsoft that we had open sourced called Dryad. And they thought, there are some really great things out of Dryad. And they grabbed those great things, and then they built Spark off of that germ of idea. So as I mentioned, it's fast because it's actually doing all of its processing from memory versus in traditional MapReduce for HD Insight or Apache Hadoop, wherever you're using Apache Hadoop, it's going to read from HDFS or storage. It's going to process and then write back to storage before it can do the next iteration. Spark can do every iteration from that data sitting in memory. Now, this is nothing new. SQL and other relational engines that are mature in the market have been doing this for decades, right? We know memory's faster. This can do it across multiple machines, scale out. And that's what makes it interesting, right? So we move away from cold, and now let's move into enrichment and curation. This is often the one service I'm going to kind of show you is often not really paid much mind to, and I think we need to spend a little time and walk you through a couple of things. Before we move to the next one, I want to first talk through machine learning. Azure Machine Learning is available as a service as well in Azure. This presents to you and to everybody the ability to connect to data, do some curation and cleansing of the data, apply multiple different types of machine learning models to experiment on the data, and then when you find that you have a good result off of that data experimentation, you can create a web service off that model to apply into your application. So if you remember at the beginning, I showed you the Emerson Electric, I'm going to go back to that slide. I showed you that Emerson Electric example. And what they were doing up here, we had Azure Machine Learning deployed as a web service. And as that data was processing through Storm, it would call that web service, send the data points, and then the web service would respond with some kind of acknowledgement that it was a binary response saying, yes, it's good, or no, we're trending bad. And with Emerson Electric, that means that they could get in front of sensor failures in a manufacturing plant well before they could before. And that's really good for somebody like Emerson Electric, who is giving that value back to their customers. So if we go back, machine learning as a service makes it much easier, much more approachable for everybody. I often talk about how there are 10 data scientists in the world. There's 1 billion developers. This is something that 1 billion developers can connect to and understand. You don't need to be a data scientist expert. Data scientists love it too. So it's a service for everybody. Now, what I really want to talk about is Azure Data Factory, though. Azure Data Factory doesn't get any love. It's the unsung hero. It's the service that does a lot of work, and it's important for your end-to-end application, and most people don't even know about it. They know about the exciting new services like Data Lake and Azure Data Warehouse. They know about SQL Database. And they know about these other data services that are pretty popular. This is what makes all of that data movement and data processing happen. It's a workflow engine that can move data from one service to another. You might say, well, that sounds like SQL Server Integration Services. It has characteristics of that. This is designed for Azure to help move data. It can also connect to your data on-prem to help move that data to the cloud as well. So this one, we're going to go back out to Azure. And we're in the new portal now. So it's much prettier. On the new portal, I selected one of the data service types over here. I just said, well, let's look at data factories. And under data factories, I've deployed a sample one. So we're going to actually connect the sample. To create a new data factory, an empty data factory, it's pretty simple. You can do this through the command line. You can do it through the SDK. You can do it through PowerShell, if you love PowerShell. Or you can do the portal. We'll just show you the portal. But in this case, we're going to just call this decode2, select the subscription, and then a resource group, and we'll just call it decode. And then what location? And this takes, I think, 30 seconds to create. So no, we don't need to say that. And then once it's created, you can start building in your orchestration. up until recently, doing something simple like saying I want to connect to a source, move the data to a destination was actually quite a lot of work with Data Factory. But we've got this data copy preview. And this actually simplifies things. It's a wizard. It's like Clippy for data movement in Azure. So you guys all know Clippy, right? May I help you? Oh, come on. Except Clippy's got jet lag too. Here we go. To use the copy data wizard, you're just going to give it a name and a description and whether or not you want to run it on a schedule. That seems helpful. And we'll just say it's daily, every one day at this time. Now, where's your source? These are all the very common sources of data, both on-prem and in the cloud. And we're going to just say we've got our data in a blob storage because we're going to do some cold batch processing on that data. Now, we want to give our linked service a name. So this is going to be the service that we're going to say is my source connection. And I want to connect to my blob storage from within a subscription. And what's my storage account? And we'll just say I've got one called Lara Test. There it is. I have a lot of storage accounts. I must work for Microsoft. So we're going to come out here, and you can it immediately says, well, I have a few containers that you've stored data in. And I know I've got some data that's sitting in this tutorial. So I can connect, double-click in there, and it's going to load, well, here are the CSVs. So we're going to actually move back up, and we're going to select that folder because I would like to iterate through all files in that folder. So we'll choose, and as I mentioned, we're going to do a copy file recursive. Go next, and it's going to say, I think I've got a comma separated value, line, feed, da-da-da-da, and here's a preview of the data. And that seems right. I don't need to worry about column names, and I'm going to send it to a destination. My destination will be Azure SQL Database. And in my Azure SQL Database, I've got a server name, and here I've got Lara R SQL Demo. And I've got a couple of databases in there. And I do need to tell it what my user login will be. Admin. And it's going to connect. And then it's going to give me some table options. So we'll select our table that we want to import the data into. And then we do our mapping. It's a wizard, right? Easy peasy. And finish. So it's going to create the connections. It's going to create everything that's needed to move that data from a source to a destination. Now, why I wanted to show this to you, I can, other than you, nobody else has used ADF, right? You've used everything. You raise your hand for everything. Has anyone used Azure Data Factory? I'm going to go back to what I said earlier. I love to just reverse engineer. And Azure Data Factory, this is a great way to say, go deploy something so I can see how it's deployed and how it's connected and learn how to create mine from scratch in the future if I need to. This is brilliant. So I let the wizard do all the work, and then I go back and I look at the output of that wizard. So if we close down that, and we can go to our diagram. Now my diagram is going to show, I've done this twice, so you can see the two in there, and then my copy pipeline, et cetera. So that's why you're seeing two. And in fact, what I'd rather do, we're going to close this one. I'm going to show you a little bit more complex example. This is the cold path processing for that predictive maintenance from my solution template I showed you at the very beginning, the Cortana Intelligence Gallery. And we can look at this monitor and manage. And this will show me all the processing of that. And so why don't we actually open this? It opens to a separate tool. This is a nice online interactive tool that you can use to monitor your data processing. And if we look here, we're going to just zoom this down. Well, not that much, I guess. You can see it's connecting to my raw blob data. It's doing some processing on it. I can click on these, and if we look off to the left, you can see the JSON properties that are generated to create that pipeline. This is what you want to reverse engineer so that you can better understand how to create your own jobs. Isn't that fun? I mean, we can go write that code ourselves, but let's use the templates to help learn. So anyway, that's what I usually do. It's how I built my career, reverse engineering everybody else's good work. So that's Azure Data Factory, and that's, in, like I said, it's very important from the enrichment and curation. Now, the final piece that I'm going to walk through on that serving layer. As I mentioned, though, when you talk about serving, everybody immediately goes to a reporting tool. But I don't want you to just think about reporting as a serving layer. Sometimes you might have customers of your data that want the data served into a relational database, or they might want it in CSV files, or they might want it in something that they can actually do more processing or analysis on it. And a reporting tool isn't the right tool for them. If you gave that Power BI reporting tool to a data scientist who wanted to experiment on the data, they would be lost. That's not the right tool for the job. And you can categorize the different kinds of jobs as things like dashboards, which are mass consumption. These are your users that just want to click, see a query, see a number, and then move on. There's interactive. This could be your data scientists, your business analysts, the people that may take the data that you have cleansed and made available to them and connect it to other data. It might be external to the organization. And then there's exploration. These are the people that might want to go ask questions that shouldn't be asked. Those questions that might require lots of processing power. These are what if. And they're not the questions that you're going to create reports for all the time, because these are just random what if, I wonder questions. So you have basically a constrained serving layer and an unconstrained serving layer. Your constrained serving layer is something that is much better befitting of reporting tools and dashboards. Your unconstrained is typically going to be data that's been cleansed and made available through some kind of other engine. Now, one of the most common questions I hear from people is, when do I use Azure Data Lake and when do I use Azure SQL Data Warehouse? Azure SQL Data Warehouse actually does fit in the serving layer. I often see people that want that data cleansed and landed into the data warehouse, Azure SQL Data Warehouse, where they can connect to it for downstream kind of analysis. Now, Azure Data Lake and Azure Data Warehouse actually complement each other beautifully. And it's typically not going to be a situation where you use one or the other. I often find people using both. It's the right tool for the right job. I often see people taking the raw data, moving that data to a blob store or some mass storage engine. That could be data lake storage now. Once it's in data lake storage, they may use things like HD Insight or USQL to batch process the data. You need a scalable engine sometimes for that raw data processing. And once they have the high-value data off of that processing, they move that into an engine optimized for query and retrieval. Has anyone worked with marketing? End-user marketing. not marketing company, but end users of data from marketing. If you haven't, let me explain to you a marketing end user. They connect to a data, and if they hit a report and that report doesn't respond within a couple of seconds, they're clicking the button saying, why isn't it coming back? They don't have patience. They can't wait. Querying off of an HD Insight or Hadoop or one of these data lakes, these are going to be typically tens of seconds to minutes to sometimes hours to process that query. It's going against a lot of data. Marketing doesn't have the patience for that. So typically you pre-process the data, cleanse it, move it to an engine where they can click it, and then they will have a reasonable response time. And when marketing's happy, then everybody's happy, right? They are usually that end user that you can tell. If you've got marketing, you want to optimize that retrieval. I've worked with them in the past as end users. So, does this make sense? Yeah, there might be variations on this theme, but this is usually what I see. So in this case, you're going to have HD Insight and Data Lake in the middle. It could be SQL Server, or it could be Data Warehouse, Azure SQL Data Warehouse, as that place where you're going to put the high-value data to stage it for additional reporting and analysis later. And what is Azure SQL Data Warehouse? Azure SQL Data Warehouse is a massively parallel processing engine available in the cloud. If you have you used Teradata, Netezza, PDW, or APS, any of these engines that scale out a relational database? And if you haven't used them and you've got a data warehouse, you've often looked at them and thought, gee, it would be nice if I could try that. But these are not easy engines to come by. They're expensive. They take months or years before you can get the approval and then get that appliance into your data center before you begin loading data. Azure Data Warehouse, it's 3 minutes, and you can start loading data. Why not? I love Azure Data Warehouse for that. The same reason I love HD Insight for what it did with Apache Hadoop. It made it immediately accessible for everybody. So Azure SQL Data Warehouse scales out your relational data into multiple, and under the covers, there's SQL databases. This is built on top of SQL Server. There are compute nodes and control nodes. And as you decide you want to scale it out or scale it up, it will add more compute nodes. If you decide you want to scale it down, it just automatically scales down the number of compute nodes, and you're going to pay for what you use. And at some point, you might scale it off, and all you're going to pay for is storage. So I'm going to actually move through. Whoops, I didn't mean to hit that button. Move through this a little bit more and get to Power BI. And Power BI, if you were in the keynote this morning and you saw my laptop freezing up, ugh. I was saying earlier, it's like my laptop had jet lag too, because I'm getting jet lag today. But Power BI is a software as a service offering that's also now available as a platform as a service, so you can embed Power BI into your applications. And Power BI gives you reporting and visualization and dashboarding, connecting to lots of sources, including Spark and Storm and HBase and Hadoop and SQL Data Warehouse and SQL Server and pretty much any source, Azure SQL Data Warehouse, or Document DB. And if we come out here, I'm going to show you an example. Maybe there it is. This is an example of some reports that I built going off of the predictive maintenance data. And you can see that some of this is including real-time updates. So as that data is streaming in, we've got a simulator running against this at all times. It's updating that data, and some of it is batch process. So this is a way that you can bring together both the hot path and the cold path in a single visualization. And to do that, we come down here, and remember at the beginning I talked about how you can connect to Power BI with Azure Stream Analytics so it can be made available? I've done that already, and it's coming into three data sets. One is flights by hour, one is aircraft monitor, and then aircraft alert. We're going to look at flights by hour just because it's easy. I've only got 6 seconds. Down to the wire, oh, 10 seconds. I'm over then, never mind. So we'll do this real quick, and I'm just gonna select my count, processed as a date, and we'll make this into a line chart, and voila. And from here, I could say I want to pin this. Oh, I need to save my report. Hello, world, because I never get to do that. We're going to pin this to an existing dashboard, and I've got one called Aircraft Maintenance. So we'll pin that, and we'll go up to our dashboard. And under Aircraft Maintenance, this is the one I just pinned. You can see I pinned this before too. And this is actually updating live. So if we continue to look at this over time, it's just going to continue to move ever so slowly because it's going over a large period of time. So it's pretty easy to connect to your data, create some visualizations, bring them together into some reports, and make it pretty. This isn't so pretty. But if I had a couple more minutes, I'm already over though, and you've been ever so patient. So, but Power BI is a great way to bring that data to a constrained user. So that is the whirlwind tour of data. So as a takeaway, go check out the gallery and go deploy the templates. Have a look at how they're applying data processing, both the hot path and the cold path, and putting that data together in visualizations and analysis. Thank you.